Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow with Political Research Associates, who assesses the consequences of the Supreme Court ruling and the Hobby Lobby contraception case. David Brown of the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project, who discusses the group's investigation in Washington County to determine if resident health problems there are linked to natural gas fracking operations. And Tomas Lopez of the Brennan Center for Justice, who discusses the status of challenges to new voter suppression laws across the nation and the likely impact on voters during this year's midterm congressional election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human rights groups say the conflict between Muslim and Christian militias in the former French colony of the Central African Republic is reminiscent of the genocide that was carried out in Bosnia during the early 1990s. Activists say that swift international action is required to stop the widespread violence and war crimes now occurring in the Central African Republic. Religious conflict exploded in March 2013 when a pro-Muslim rebel movement known as Seleka overthrew President François Bozizé. Over the last year, Christian militias mobilized, pitting religious and ethnic communities against one another. Today, only 20,000 Muslims remain in the African country in enclaves surrounded by pro-Christian militias. There are currently some 2,000 French soldiers in the Central African Republic, along with 5,000 troops from the African Union, who have thus far failed to halt the violence. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders reports rising cases of malaria and lack of clean water and sanitation in sprawling refugee camps. 50 years after the passage of the historic Federal Voting Rights Act, Native Americans living on reservations still face significant barriers to voting. According to the news magazine In These Times, Native Americans cannot register on the reservations where they live and must travel long distances to vote, in often hostile white communities. In a 2012 study of voting patterns, Claremont Graduate University professor Jean Schrodel found that in Blaine County, Montana, 46% of white voters cast an absentee ballot, compared to only 18% of Native Americans living on the neighboring reservation. To confront the double standards on voting rights, people from three Montana reservations, Fort Belknap, Northern Cheyenne, and Crow, filed a lawsuit against three county officials and the Montana Secretary of State. The plaintiffs sought equal access to absentee voting. The Native activists received support from the U.S. Justice Department in their case to challenge gerrymandered districts, registration barriers, and harassment at the polls. In a mid-June out-of-court settlement, the three counties agreed to set up satellite voting centers on local reservations and pay the plaintiffs legal fees. Eugene Scalia, son of conservative U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, has won the reputation as the go-to guy to derail implementation of the 2010 Frank Dodd banking reform law. Scalia has won three cases against the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, challenging new rules and regulations. His formula is fairly simple. The corporate lawyer demands a full cost-benefit analysis for each regulation, which substantially slows down new banking rules from taking effect. According to Mother Jones magazine, Scalia began using this cost-benefit strategy in 2004 in challenging the SEC on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce over a rule requiring mutual fund companies to name outside members to their boards of directors. Scalia targeted Dodd-Frank with an early challenge to the mandate giving shareholders expanded rights to oust corporate board members. A panel of judges on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals agreed and criticized the SEC for being arbitrary and capricious. Now Scalia has his sights set on preventing implementation of the Volcker Rule, a key element of the post-Great Recession too-big-to-fail doctrine, which bars banks from certain risky trading strategies involving hedge funds. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
In a landmark ruling in the Burwell versus Hobby Lobby Stores case, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision on June 30th that allows the owners of some for-profit corporations to impose their religious beliefs on their employees when it comes to health care issues. The five justices of the court's conservative majority held that family-owned businesses can deny their female workers contraceptives as part of their employee health insurance plan when the owners object to certain forms of birth control required under the Federal Affordable Care Act. In an extension of the High Court's 2010 Citizens United decision that affirmed corporate personhood for the purpose of making unrestricted political campaign contributions, the conservative majority has now declared that incorporated businesses have the right to hold religious beliefs just like natural-born humans. While Justice Samuel Alito, writing for the majority, emphasized that this ruling was narrow in scope, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her forceful dissent, stated that this decision of startling breadth would allow corporations to opt out of almost any law that they find incompatible with their sincerely held religious beliefs. While some initial analysis of the ruling mistakenly minimized the effect of this decision to a small number of closely held corporations, upon closer examination, it turns out that fully 90% of all businesses in the U.S. are family-owned, employing over 50% of the nation's workforce. Closely held or non-publicly traded corporations that potentially could take advantage of the ruling include companies such as Cargill, Dell, Heinz, Dole Foods, Koch Industries, Public Supermarkets, Ernst & Young, Amway, Toys R Us, Hilton, and Bloomberg. Your reporter spoke with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow with Political Research Associates, who assesses the likely consequences of the Supreme Court ruling in the Hobby Lobby case.
This is the first time in the history of the United States that a private secular corporation has been granted religious rights under the First Amendment. It's an extraordinary development, and that is probably where its greatest significance is going to be over time, as as we know, a Supreme Court decision comes down, and a body of federal case law develops as a result of it. We don't know what that body's going to look like yet, but I would guess that it would be related to that. But the other thing is, it's kind of lost in a lot of the coverage, and that is that this is not just about contraceptives, and that is it's about only four contraceptives, really. The insurance package that Hobby Lobby provides its employees is glad to provide coverage of 16 other kinds of contraceptives, including birth control pills. These are four contraceptives that, as a matter of the religious beliefs of the owners of the company, they say cause abortions. Now, this includes emergency contraception and IUDs. The medical science and the American Medical Association and others say that's not true. They prevent fertilization of the egg, but not the implantation. And so it's not an abortifacient according to medical science, but as a matter of religious belief, the Supreme Court has now said that a company can defy medical science and get an exemption from federal law. And that's an extraordinary development.
As you read the Constitution and many other legal scholars, it seems that there is an erosion of the barrier between church and state. And in the long run, what is your concern about where this particular conservative majority on the Supreme Court could lead the country?
Well, I think that, let me back up and say that I think that the Hobby Lobby case and some of the others is an explicitly theocratic slant to the direction of American jurisprudence, if it stays headed in this direction. Again, it's a small wedge, but it's a wedge. Now, that said, the church-state separation means religious freedom for everyone. We're all equal in the eyes of the law, regardless of our particular religious beliefs or non-beliefs. We all have equal standing. And government is to be the uncompromised guarantor of those rights of individual conscience. Here we have situations where, particularly in the case of Hobby Lobby, but also in the case of the buffer zone case, where it's okay to discriminate against people and to bully individuals' rights of individual conscience. And that's a bad direction in which we end up being pitted against ourselves in terms of our religious beliefs, our general religious culture, and even by state and by region. There are places in the country where this kind of decision is more popular than others. And I think we're going to be seeing pretty great state and regional tensions over this kind of stuff in the not too distant future.
On the issue of public opinion, as you said earlier, the Supreme Court decision here could inflame public opinion around the country in places where this kind of ruling against contraceptives through employers or particular employers could have a lot of people angry at what was decided here. On the other hand, there'll be some political impact, no doubt, in the coming elections where Republicans' objections to abortion and many politicians on the right's objections to even providing contraceptives will be an issue in the campaigning for Congress this November. Overall, where do you think public opinion is at in a case like this?
Well, I've already seen some polling, and I think it was even in the New York Times talking about a poll of like 10,000 people, and people think that insurance should cover contraceptives, period. And that, you know, by a vast majority, it's something like, you know, 53 to 37 or something like that. So at least in terms of generalized public opinion, yeah. I don't think people are as animated about this as the political community is. But nevertheless, I think you're right, coming into an election, that this will be a polarizing and demagogued issue far a proportion to what's actually involved. And it will be about, you know, whether the government should cover contraception. And you just hear how Fox News will frame it. But the larger issues of corporate personhood are probably the things that really most need to be talked about. I mean, what is the religious freedom of a corporation? Will it go beyond the narrow decision that Alito wrote? It seems likely, given that there's so many other issues of the expansion of the notion of corporate personhood. So that's what I hope that people will be prepared to talk about more forcefully with candidates of both parties.
That was Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and author of the book Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Find more analysis of the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby ruling on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In what they say is the first such study of its kind in the U.S., a team of scientists and public health professionals has examined a group of residents of southwestern Pennsylvania to determine if the health problems they report are the result of living near the industrial practice of horizontal fracturing for natural gas known as fracking. That's the process that involves drilling deep underground into tight shale formations, injecting a million or more gallons of water, sand, and a list of secret chemicals to shatter the rock and release the gas. The formerly bucolic Pennsylvania landscape has been transformed by the construction of well pads, gas flaring towers, and the rumbling of hundreds of heavy trucks that service the sites, traveling on local roads and highways. Air and water pollution related to fracking operations has prompted many residents with health problems to seek answers about the possible links of their illness to the natural gas extraction process. David Brown, director of Public Health Toxicology for Environment and Human Health Incorporated, help coordinate the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Brown, past chief of environmental epidemiology and occupational health in Connecticut, who discusses the project's investigation, where the objective is to determine the cause of residents' health complaints.
We look for health effects, potential health effects, in people living in Southwest Pennsylvania, but we looked in a fairly traditional way for public health, which is to identify the people who were thought they were ill or who seemed to be ill, and examine them and their situation, including their housing and their things that were near their housing, to try to determine what their health status was and what potential things might be affecting their health. We knew that the gas fracking was going on very near their property and where they were living. And so we went to Pennsylvania. It involved a nurse practitioner who would examine people. It involved community involvement people who were able to communicate with the population, the people, and have them explain what their problems were. We also looked at the scientific information that was available about what the exposures might be that these particular families were being exposed to. What we found was that there was clearly health effects that were occurring in a portion of the people that we're talking to, And those health effects involved physical effects, for example, nosebleeds, headaches, increased asthma attacks, skin rashes, and some what we call cognitive effects, confusion, inability to sleep, high senses of worry and anxiety because they had essentially lost their ability to control their environment around their homes. There was gas drilling going on around their homes, extraction of gas. Fumes were getting into their homes and near their homes, and they were actually getting their water. Some were finding that their water was contaminated and undrinkable. There was a reasonably large number of people involved. We think somewhere between Washington County, Pennsylvania, is about 200,000 people in it, and we think that the numbers are of those people who are living near gas wells and or gas production facilities who are potentially being exposed to emissions from the facilities, either through the air, the water, or the soil. There was probably 5, maybe 15% of that population was in an area that looked like they could be at risk.
But, David Brown, correlation is not necessarily causation. Are you convinced these maladies are the result of fracking and not something else?
Well, we're pretty convinced that it has to do with the gas activity that's going on down there. One of the things we're looking for before we can answer the question that you just asked is public health is called a case description. What is different about this population than other people that might be sick in Washington County? And, you know, everybody has a certain amount of illness around them, so we wanted to sort out which was which. And I think we're getting close to the kind of exposures. We did a simple process where we took those people that we had examined, or those individuals from each family that we had examined. We took their data, put it into a standardized format, and then gave it to a panel of experts and said, okay, identify which of these people you think would be likely to be sick anyway, which would be potentially affected by the gas drilling, and if so, what would they be affected by. And we found a portion of those people that in terms of the time when the drilling started and when they reported that they were ill, in terms of the distance that they were from the gas facilities, and in terms of the other health conditions they had, that could only be, or the most likely explanation was that they were being affected by the gas drilling.
On July 13th, thousands of people are expected to protest at the offices of FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington, D.C., against its likely approval of liquefied natural gas export facilities that would be supplied by an increase in fracking around the country.
FERC takes a very narrow view of what it's responsible for in a very broad problem. FERC could go a long ways towards correcting this problem by saying, you have to tell us what's in the gas line. You're going to have to tell us where you got it from and how you got it. FERC doesn't do that. FERC has said, no, we're responsible for moving the gas, and that's what we do, and that's our charge. If they would be a little more thoughtful, in my judgment, about what their responsibilities are on a larger scale, the risks would be understood. As it is now, one would have to be very naive to allow the person who provides the pipe to decide whether gas will come into your neighborhood or not.
That was David Brown of the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. Find more information about the project and the hazards of natural gas fracking by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. One year after the Supreme Court's controversial and narrow 5-4 ruling, which overturned a key section of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, nearly half the states across the country have imposed new obstacles to voting. These include restrictive voter ID laws, limiting early voting hours, and new requirements making voter registration more difficult. These election regulations, ushered in by mostly Republican governors and legislatures since 2010, disproportionately affect the voting rights of minorities, young people, senior citizens, and other voters viewed as likely to cast ballots for Democratic Party candidates. Unless successfully challenged, these new restrictions will be in place in 22 states for the important midterm congressional elections this November 4th. Already, voting rights advocates have initiated lawsuits to overturn restrictive election regulations in 7 states. In a hopeful sign, a federal judge in Milwaukee struck down Wisconsin's voter identification law on April 29th, declaring that a requirement that voters show a state-issued photo ID at the polls imposes an unfair burden on poor and minority voters. Although the Voting Rights Amendment Act of 2014 was introduced in January, Congress has thus far failed to pass this legislation, which would restore the pre-clearance section of the Voting Rights Act struck down by the Supreme Court last year. Your reporter spoke with Tomas Lopez, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice, who discusses the status of challenges to new voter suppression laws across the nation and the likely impact on voters.
One big lawsuit that some of your listeners may have heard about concerns the photo ID law in Wisconsin. And earlier this year, federal court actually ruled against that law. And in its decision, the judge wrote that the law would actually prevent more legitimate votes from being cast than fraudulent votes. So that's one example of a law, you know, that we think is a really problematic one, one that's restrictive, but that the courts have actually taken a really positive step with. Also earlier this year, there was a state court that ruled against the voter ID law in Arkansas, and that's an ongoing concern. Another two laws that your listeners might also have heard about are in Texas and in North Carolina. Texas has a strict photo ID law that only allows certain people to vote only if they have certain kinds of identification. And so the state's own early estimates showed that between 600,000 and 800,000 voters did not have the kind of ID required there, and that Latinos were 46 to 120% more likely to lack an ID than white voters. And those were just early estimates. That case is going to trial later this year. In North Carolina, the state legislature last year passed one of the country's most restrictive voting laws. It cut back on early voting. It also got rid of a provision allowing citizens to register to vote on Election Day, and the litigation there is also ongoing.
So it's unclear, really, I guess, how many of these restrictive voting laws will be in place when voters go to the polls this November. It'll be up to these individual courts. What is the likelihood that some of these cases could be decided before the Supreme Court in terms of the challenges to these restrictive laws?
Well, I mean, certainly this is an issue that has a lot of meaning around the nation. This is something that we think matters in all 50 states. I don't know that I'm in the position to say which of these cases is going to reach the Supreme Court or if or when the Supreme Court is actually going to take them. But we obviously think this is this is an issue of the highest importance.
Tomas, is there any reliable estimate on the numbers of voters who may not get a chance to cast a ballot this November because of these laws?
Well, I don't know that I could give you an aggregate number. You know, what we know is that really large swaths of the population can be affected by restrictive laws in one way or another. To give you one example, North Carolina last year passed a law that restricted early voting. It narrowed the window. Simply looking at the data, you see that early voting was something that was really popular among African-American voters. You know, the concern about these laws is that they can particularly affect members of minority groups, students, the elderly. And we really are worried about what can happen if they're allowed to fully go into effect.
So no numbers, but, I've heard estimates that hundreds of thousands, certainly numbers that could change the results of elections if particular voters don't have their votes counted.
And as I mentioned, we looked at those early numbers from Texas that estimated in the high hundreds of thousands, and again, early estimates that talked about the numbers of individuals that lacked ID. When we look at this information, what we see is that these are laws that do have consequences, and that we're doing our best to actually make sure that people are able to vote. You know, what we want is a system in every state and across the country where voting is free, fair, and accessible. And we think those laws cut against that in a way that really cuts against our democratic principles.
It is so hard to get your head around the fact that one political party would want to restrict potentially millions of people from voting and then being able to get away with it without the public outcry that I would expect is a really concerning, you know, part of the public reaction to this whole thing. And I know certainly at the Brennan Center and political activists, this is a real issue, you know, at the top of the list. But for the vast majority in the country, it's really not high on the agenda. And at least from where I'm sitting, and I'm probably you too, it should be more on the radar screen of most people.
You know, I think you bring up a really important point, and that's that the right to vote should be above partisanship. You know, every citizen's got this right, and you know, these efforts to make voting more difficult, more complicated, they cut against who we are. And to the extent that affected voters are more likely to vote one way or another, it doesn't justify those restrictions. This is how the public expresses its preferences. This is how we get to determine the people who make our policies. And it's really important for people to know that there are also really good things that can happen with voting, that we can take steps to make things like early voting more available, to modernize the system of voter registration, to make the voting process more user-friendly. And these are the things that Congress and our state legislature should be focusing on. I think that one thing that is really heartening to come out of this process is that we're seeing people stand up and fight back. We're seeing people who are willing to stand up and defend the right to vote. You know, we've seen Moral Monday in North Carolina. We've seen around the country these lawsuits take action, and we've also seen people simply register to vote and then, if necessary, wait in line for hours to vote to make sure that their voice is heard. And so, you know, I do think in the face of all of this, it's important to remember that people aren't necessarily being passive in response.
That was Tomas Lopez, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice. For more information on the campaign to restore and strengthen voting rights across the U.S., visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.